HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KIBU programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kibu.fm/give or text KIBU to 44321. Stay tuned now for KIBU News in depth. We're speaking with some of the organizers of this year's Village Building Convergence. Stick around.
KIBU News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is KIBU News in Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. Coming up in June in Portland, the Village Building Convergence will kick off the 8 days of workshops, placemaking, presentations, and community building. Here to talk with us about the project is Mark Lakeman, founder of City Repair and the organizer of VBC. Welcome to KIBU News in Depth.
Thanks. Really appreciate being here again.
So, first of all, thanks for taking the time to meet with us. And let's start with some of the history here for people who may not have been to the Village Building Convergence before. What does the project look like?
Well, we are literally trying to install an alternative infrastructure across the city of Portland. And our dream is that Portland, you know, as so many people already kind of think of it, then represents a model to other people. And in particular, I mean, since KIBU has a lot of kind of, woke listeners, our project is to retrofit the colonial grid with the gathering places that are so profoundly missing. And when I say that, I'm pointing out that American neighborhoods are really not villages at all. In many ways, they are just developments of housing. People popularly talk about food deserts, you know, and that's an issue to not be able to walk anywhere, or placelessness, like there's nowhere to go for recreation or relief. But in our view, the most profoundly missing piece of the community fabric is actually the public sort of social space, the public square. And it's kind of paradoxical. You know, we save our money, we have to fly across the ocean to visit societies and villages where there are actually so many kinds of gathering places that people treat each other differently, and the result is super low crime rates and super low crime rates and then super high public health indicators, which is exactly the opposite of what we experience in America, largely as a product of our isolation from each other. So we're trying to retrofit the city with places, cultures of participation that inhabit those places, the power of a true sort of democratic effect, or you might say the effect of that was intended in the idea of the demos, where people actually have a voice in their own place. And then the community activities, you might say rituals like the barn raising. And the end of my kind of preamble here is that the Village Building Convergence is an attempt to restore the effect of a barn raising all across the city.
Can you go a little bit into the history of the Village Building Convergence? You mentioned it's in its 24th year this year, which is an incredible achievement. Can you kind of talk about how it all got started, how it's sustained itself?
Yeah, it's good to talk about. I think people have been in a kind of a down mindset for the last few years for a lot of different reasons, and it's good to refresh people's memory that I think, you know, a lot about Portland activism, Portland culture is defined by positive, constructive engagement. Like, we're not just going to fight for a better world, we're going to literally create it. And that's really been our record. For 24 years, we have been revolutionizing the streets especially, but commercial spaces, institutional spaces, private spaces. We've been trying to inspire people to re-village their blocks, to re-village their intersections. And, you know, everyone's seen these, like, street murals across the city, sometimes paintings in between the streets. The Oregonian and the Willamette Week have never helped Portlanders realize that any Portlander can literally go talk to other Portlanders in their neighborhood and decide to transform a street intersection into a public square. And this process is for free. It's done rapidly. The permits are free. And City Repair, the organization, stands ready to help any community who wants to do this. So the Department of Transportation, working with the City Council, you know, with us kind of nudging everyone years ago, legalized the transformation of street intersections into public squares all over the city an unlimited number of times in every residential zone for free. And that's what Portland basically can offer the rest of the world. And now all we have to do is get outside and do it. It starts with people painting the street, because that's a way to have a, you know, quick action impact, big emotional impact on everyone that has this unifying effect on people who are used to not even talking to each other. So I'm happy to report we've done this a couple hundred times in terms of the street murals. And when I say murals, I'm talking about people who live right there within two blocks. They get together, they decide what unifying symbol or reference or metaphor works for them, and then they fund it and they install it, they program it, and they have the power of place. So we've done that hundreds of times, and then I think the overall amount of projects across the city in lots of different circumstances, using permaculture, using natural building, using recycled materials, all it being an ecological kind of demonstration project, is something around the area of 800 times. So we're very densely saturated, and we still feel like we're only just beginning.
Can you maybe go into some more of these VBC projects? In past years, you mentioned, like, street painting, just to kind of give, you know, people who maybe aren't familiar with these projects, people that might be interested, an idea of where they might get started with something like placemaking.
Yeah. Well, let me just say that famously, when you go to a place like the Rebuilding Center, you're looking at a product of the village building convergence. And when you see these street murals, and usually any earthen building, straw bale building, straw clay, cob building that you, or bench that you might come across in the city, those are usually the result of the actions of the village building convergence. And the way that you get started, well, frankly, we don't want anyone to wait for us. If they just want to go out and reclaim some urban space and practice their power, you know, don't wait for us. But if you want our help, then you can go to cityrepair.org and look up programs or look up projects, and you'll find that right now, as of this weekend, we've just begun the process of receiving project proposals from all over the city for people who want to do things. And a lot of people come in just saying, hey, I don't even know what I want to do. I just want to help anybody who wants to do something. So we're getting people stepping forward to volunteer. Anybody with any skill set or no skill set at all can come in and get involved. You know, we're just kind of, you know, when we talk about village building, we mean everything. And let me just step back a little bit. Like, there's so many things that are broken about the modern city that is just based on capitalization, expansionism. I mean, the classic definition of the city-state in the Western Hemisphere is that everyone is separated, stratified, and specialized. So when we're village building, we're trying to help people connect with others and be part of a network that helps. This is how I put it. I almost cry when I think of it. Like, Americans walk around thinking they're alone. And what we're trying to do in what we call the VBC, or Village Building Convergence, is help people feel like they're part of a greater whole, that they have tremendous, limitless power because they're connected to so many other people. So, you know, maybe you can make music, but you don't know how to make food. Maybe you can make food, but you don't know how to drive a nail. And once we come together and we start to just sort of join our skill sets together, we find that we can literally build anything. And that's really the point of the barn raising, to restore that sense that together we can do anything.
Can you talk a little bit about throughout these 24 consecutive years that the VBC has been, they've been held, what sort of things have changed over that time?
Yeah. Well, okay, I can tell you that we had certain aspirations that we scarcely wanted to communicate because they were so big. Like, we dreamt of changing the world. And I think so many people have this urge, like so many people look in each other's eyes, even across the political divide, and they know something's wrong. Yet so few people actually give themselves 5 minutes or 15 minutes to imagine how they might actually make the world a better place. You know, if only a certain amount of funding would come this way, if we could only elect a certain sort of person to an executive position, somehow, some way, we might have make the world a better place. What we did at the beginning was we dreamt of some way to create a horizontal effect and a vertical integration through the vertical systems of the city. And I would say that we have achieved that in a mighty way. And when I say that, I never have dreamt that it would be perfect and it would be easy. I never have, you know, and I also knew when we got started, there's so much I didn't understand about the system. But one thing we did know is that the problem and also the power of the system are the human beings inside of it. So from the very beginning, we were engaging people, you know, with dignity and respect, so that even if we were in opposition, even if we had to say, no, we will not stop this behavior, because we've awakened to the fact that there is nowhere to gather in our entire neighborhood, so we will paint the street, we will build features on all the corners, we will tear up the yards and turn them into gardens, because nobody else is going to do this and we can't wait around anymore. And after all, what we were actually waiting for the whole time was our own power. So I hope that's an answer to the question. We basically have accomplished a turning of the tide, like on a grassroots level when we first got started. Voices even in KBOO here, we've gotten some apologies about this in later years. Like, they thought all they should do is oppose what we were doing, because the only form of activism that they understood was to fight against what outrages you. So I think we've helped to redefine activism, and we've brought new tools into the light for weapons of mass construction, if you will, instead of just fighting. I think that we've really raised the value of civic participation and made it begin with communities right where people live. And I think that we have really broken down the wall between the city government and the community, so that the city government now understands they are the community. And again, this isn't perfect. And there's definitely been some fallback in the last few years with all of the isolation and emergencies that have been going on, a lot of misunderstanding and separation. But where we had been at our apex was that the city understood that they were the community, and the community was very clear that they were the city. And once we were seeing that way, we had reached a height of collaboration maybe unprecedented in our history. And we're back.
So for people who might not know about VBC or placemaking, what do you wish people knew more about this project, about this term placemaking and how it's applied?
I guess I would say I don't expect everybody to even understand what we're talking about, because the idea of isolation being an issue. Has only really reared its head for a lot of people in the last couple of years as we've really intensely experienced it. I would say I wish that people understood that they live in the colonial grid, and that the entire reality is designed first on paper in the National Land Ordinance of 1785, which accounts for so many reasons why power and wealth is concentrated in this country, why the supplanting of indigenous ways of being to enable the capitalization of our very reality. Like, there's a reason for it. So I would like to say to people, like, you can address that. You can be an actor in your own history, in your own story. You can join together with other people. And I think this is our best chance. Again, there will never be a continuity of political leadership nor the funding for us to do what only we can do. So I would say, I wish that we could, I hope that we can, awaken within people the realization and the dream that they can act on their own behalf and practice their voice and power and not wait around anymore. And that's what the VBC is here to do. We are absolute nerds and dorks in the sense that we love to help people do what they want to do. We're not here to tell people what to do. We want to know what your idea is, and then we want to step in and support. So you have all the help you need.
So if listeners are interested in learning more about the VBC, and in particular if they're interested in submitting a project proposal, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, go to cityrepair.org and then find the programs on that page, and you will quickly find the Village Building Convergence, and it will probably say submit a proposal. click onto that and you'll see that there's a form to fill out. Give us your name, where you are, and what it's basically a self-assessment. You think about, you know, who's around you, what help you have, what resources you have, and what resources you need. Send that in, and then we start the conversation.
Mark, do you have any final thoughts before we leave?
I'm just super excited. I can't wait to do this again. I'm 24 years in a row. Let's make this bigger and badder and more wonderful than ever.
It's an incredible achievement. Mark, thank you so much for coming to KABU and meeting with us today.
Thanks, Reed.
I've been speaking with Mark Lakeman, founder of City Repair. City Repair is helping to plan the Village Building Convergence 2024, which kicks off June 15th, with 8 days of workshops, placemaking, presentations, and community building. More information about the project is online at villagebuildingconvergence.com. For KABU News in Depth, I'm Reed Johnson. Stay tuned for more In Depth coming up after this.
You are listening to KABU News In Depth. What accounts for Russia's very strong reaction to any kind of activity near its borders that leaders might see as even a possible threat? University of Montana history professor Richard Drake has been looking into that question. He recently wrote an article for Counterpunch about the 1971 testimony of four American historians, Adam Ullman, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., William Appleman Williams, and D.F. Fleming, before a House subcommittee that wanted to hear their views about the origins of the Cold War and what course it might take as the Vietnam War raged on. KABU contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Drake about the testimony of these historians and how it relates to U.S. foreign policy today.
When I was reading your article, you were focusing on what's happened in the 20th century. Is there something in the Russian habit of mind that goes back? Is it somehow ingrained deep in people who grow up there that they can be invaded at any time?
It dealt with some of the reasons why Russia is unusually sensitive to the prospect of foreign troops massing on its borders. The article really took root from research I'd been doing on a book about William Appleman Williams, a revisionist historian of the Cold War. I discovered that Williams and three other historians gathered in the House of Representatives subcommittee meeting in 1971 to hear what the leading historians in the country had to say about the war in Vietnam, which in 1971 was still raging, and what likely future developments would take place in the Cold War as a result of the war in Vietnam. Now, the other historians who were there to testify were Arthur Meyer Schlesinger Jr., Kennedy advisor and consultant, liberal Democrat.
Part of the Brain Trust, yeah.
Yeah, part of the Brain Trust. Adam Ulam, who was a Russian historian, a very conservative, very supportive of American foreign policy in the Cold War, Harvard professor, and D.F. Fleming, a Vanderbilt historian, left of center of the political spectrum in interpreting the Vietnam War and the Cold War. He explained to them, the Russians have had a uniquely disastrous experience. As I listened to what Fleming had to say, I kept thinking about the war in Ukraine in our own day and why the Russians might have been unusually concerned about the possibility of yet another invasion, adding to the collection of invasions that they've experienced. Fleming gave a marvelous overview of the catastrophes that befell Russia, beginning in 1915 when the Germans invaded in the First World War, and then with the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the capitalist states invaded Russia trying to squelch the Bolshevik Revolution. They hated and feared Bolshevism. They knew what that meant. That meant a condemnation of capitalism. So this was uppermost in their minds to annihilate the possibility of that threat spilling beyond Russia's borders. The Nazi invasion, 1941 to 1945, the catastrophic consequences of that invasion, some 15 Russian cities were completely destroyed, possibly thousands of villages destroyed, some 27 million Russians died in that war. And so Fleming tried to explain that if you want to understand Russian attitudes toward the West in 1971, you need to be aware of this backstory. And unfortunately, our leaders and our people are not aware of it. They have a very shaky understanding of what happened in Russia. And reading that testimony, I thought this insight is maybe even more pertinent for 2024 than it was in 1971 for explaining Putin's reaction to the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO and having NATO's nuclear weapons on his own border.
And we also sometimes hear that when it comes to Ukraine in particular, Russian leaders view it as part of the heart of Russia. That is like ripping out their heart in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a large Russian population in eastern Ukraine. And as a result of that fact and the mistreatment that they endured following the Maidan Revolution of 2014, from that point on, the Russians in the eastern part of Ukraine felt victimized by developments for which the government of Ukraine was responsible. I think all those factors combined to create a situation in Putin's mind, remaining aware of this historical backdrop, a situation that he thought was an existential threat for Russia.
So the invasions that took place before the First World War and the Bolshevik Revolution, you would say are not as relevant?
No, I would say they're very relevant. In fact, I'm glad you raised that point because I added a section to that article concerning the work of Arnold Toynbee, British historian. He wrote a short book in 1953 called The World and the West. And his book is sort of an addendum to the argument that D.F. Fleming made in 1971. What Toynbee, with his wide-ranging understanding of history, he says, if you look at what has befallen Russia, not just considering the 20th century, Toynbee says, you really have to go back to the 13th century, because then Western invasions became a fact of life for the Russian people. The invasion of the Poles in 1610, the invasion of the Swedes in 1709.
Not the Mongols.
Huh. Now, he doesn't address that one, but he said there were others that might have been listed, but the French in 1812, and of course, the Germans twice, 1915 and 1941. So what Toynbee adds to this historical picture of Russian sensitivity to border security, it's the eternal concern because of what they've experienced for hundreds of years. Toynbee adds a very important dimension to this interpretation of Russian history, really as a series of crises and traumas stemming from repeated invasions coming from the West. The war in Ukraine has to be understood in the same historical context, and it is not in the United States.
It's simply a matter of the Russians violating the integrity of Ukraine.
That's exactly it. And it's an interpretation that totally ignores history. It's only concerned with the political objectives, I think, of the United States. And there's absolutely no attention that I'm able to observe on American media paid to the Russian experience with invasions from the West, their fear of this, and why they could not allow the situation in Ukraine to stand.
Yeah, I think it's more the sense that look what they did after World War II. They took over Eastern Europe. Isn't this a repeat of that?
That's another point I think that D.F. Fleming, this historian from Vanderbilt, that he emphasized. He said, look, you just have to understand, although what Joseph Stalin did in 1945, imposing Russia's hegemony over Eastern Europe, was wrong, it's understandable, especially after losing 27 million people.
They did do the bulk of the fighting in Europe.
They won the war. Far more instrumental in defeating Nazi Germany than either the United States or the UK was. And so we really have to look at what happened after World War II from the viewpoint of the Russians and try to understand why that issue of border security was paramount to them, having just gone through this horrendously vicious war with Nazi Germany. Of course, they were going to say, no, we want no possible threat of that kind to materialize again. And I think that's just a focal point of Russian thinking in their dealing with their own foreign affairs.
And I imagine that's why there was opposition in Moscow to the reunification of Germany that Gorbachev agreed to.
Very much so. And this is why Gorbachev wanted to have assurances that NATO was not going to be moving toward the Russian border. And of course, we gave those assurances and then betrayed them. And I think the performance of American foreign policy leaders on this Ukraine issue has been extremely shabby. We have a situation there resulting in hundreds of thousands of casualties and incredible destruction that should have been solved diplomatically before February 24, 2022. There had to be a much more imaginative effort made there. Instead, what we did was to follow the Wolfowitz doctrine, which was really just to completely militarize American foreign policy. There will be no peer competitor allowed to emerge. This was 1992 when Wolfowitz presented this dogma, which has become a core element in American foreign policy thinking, in order to understand why we insisted on pushing NATO to Russia's borders. You have to keep that Wolfowitz doctrine in mind. This whole idea of following the Cold War, well, now that we're on top, we're going to stay on top. Well, the world is changing, and we need to change with it and to understand what the best way is to maintain peace and stability in the world instead of promoting the exigencies of the American empire, which I think is the only thing uppermost in the minds of our leaders.
Yeah, it seems like it would take a much more enlightened leadership to break free of that.
But where is that leadership going to come from is the great question of the moment as this 2024 presidential campaign gets underway and we listen to what President Biden has to say, what Donald Trump has to say. It's just all talk about the American empire. In Gaza, in Ukraine, there's no real effort to promote peace. The only effort is to promote war. And this is a sickness that is going to result in a threat to the world. The leaders in charge are incompetent. They really have an inadequate appreciation for history. They are caught in the toils of American imperialism. And this is driving the world into a dreadful corner.
If we don't oppose them, we are, in a sense, giving in to tyranny.
Well, that's the argument, but it seems to me to be a very unconvincing argument.
Apparently not to a lot of people.
I understand that. I understand that. But I think they're wrong, and I think they have to be shown to be wrong. If the world is to escape this constant spiral of war, revolution, and terror, being victimized by a leadership class with no imagination whatsoever for peace, the war party is leading us off a cliff. The Global South has completely resisted the American policy of economic sanctions against Russia. It's reacted in an almost overwhelmingly negative way because they don't
trust. And it has opposed U.S. policy in Gaza as well.
Even more there. The destruction in Gaza is the crime of our time. There's nothing more evil going on in the world than that. It's a frightening, horrible atrocity. And to hear our leaders defending that and trying to explain why we need to fund it and to arm the perpetrators of that assault on these defenseless people, these 2,000-pound bombs that we're supplying, this is Exhibit A for the case that the leaders we have are inadequate to the moment. Unfortunately, the resistance and the dismay and all the moral protests have not affected policy. I really link Ukraine and Gaza. In my mind, they're really two examples of the same problem. And it's a point that D.F. Fleming makes in his testimony in 1971. What's happened in the world, what's happened in American foreign policy since the end of World War II is that we really have been in the business of defending the Bretton Woods financial system that was erected in 1944 at that economic conference where the International Monetary Fund was created, the World Bank was created. And that economic system is what we've been promoting worldwide. We've promoted it in Vietnam. We're promoting it in Ukraine. We're promoting it in all of our foreign policy, military undertakings are connected with that. Another great historian, Gabriel Kolko, tried to show how you begin to understand what's going on in the world when you realize that one thread unites all of our wars. It's promoting this corporate capitalist system that was refined, developed at the Bretton Woods Conference 1944, and making this the global entity. That's the essence, the foundation of the rules-based order that President Biden is always talking about. And the question is that the order we really need? Is that the one we should be sacrificing all these lives for? Or do we need to rethink our system? Billions of people living on less than $2 a day. You wonder why there's terrorism and revolution and war in the world? The whole system is wretchedly wrong. And by promoting it and expanding it, we've embarked on a crusade that is unworthy of us as a people. I think our leaders need to be replaced. I think the foreign policy team that we currently have in Washington, the best thing that could happen to them would be retirement.
In the Vietnam era, you know, there was so much protest that eventually it did get to Congress and they did cut off the funding.
This is true, but as those four historians I mentioned at the very outset of our discussion today, even though they were very different in their reaction to American foreign policy, they all agreed that the Vietnam War was a catastrophe. And it was Arthur Meyer Schlesinger who actually said the words I'm about to repeat. The war in Vietnam has been a horrible and expensive education. We must have no more Vietnams. Well, we've been having nothing but more Vietnams ever since. I get as excited as any American about presidential politics. But, you know, you really have to get discouraged when you think about how little difference it makes in our foreign policy, whether a Democrat or a Republican gets in, because the foreign policies stay the same. They don't change. The heart of the matter, I think, is on the negative side. The course of empire in American history is our great crisis, and we need to confront it. We need to understand it. That's what the 1,000 military bases worldwide are for. They're there to protect the empire. And we have to ask ourselves, is this the right investment we should be making? Is the military-industrial complex the right defining institution for America, which it has become? My argument would be no. Our greatest historians said, no, the course of American empire will lead us to the same destination that every single empire in recorded history has arrived.